the College Football Fix Podcast. With Paul Meyerberg and Dan Wolkin. This is the College Football Fix Podcast from USA Today Sports.
Final week of the college football regular season on the College Football Fix. Just a few days away, we're going to have our playoff, Paul Meyerberg. It's quite interesting. There's a lot of conspiracy theories out there. There's a lot of what ifs. I've said it all season, the 10th year of the 14 playoff, the last year of the 14 playoff, this could definitely be the most complicated one yet. There's just so many things still kind of up in the air. But what are the things that you are focused on right now as we get into championship week? What are you going to be locked in on Friday and Saturday? What do you think is going to happen?
I think it has a chance, Dan, to be the easiest one, right? I mean, don't we also believe that at this point for the committee? I mean, all you got to do is hold serve, and things are going to be pretty simple for them. Having said that, I think the game to watch for me is the game you're at, and that's Alabama-Georgia. I think that's the one that could cause the most chaos and leave the most dramatically controversial result, which is an SEC champion not in the field, which is conceivable, not probable. Certainly the more conceivable result of that is that Georgia's left out of the field, which would be extremely controversial. So that's really the game I'm watching. I mean, the other ones are interesting, but not altogether impactful. I mean, obviously Florida State, that's big, but the Pac-12 game in the grand scheme of things is not overwhelmingly important. I mean, except for the teams, because the winner is getting in. So yeah. Alabama, Georgia, to me, that's a tipping point, and you'll be there, right? That's a 4 o'clock on Saturday, 4:30?
Yeah, so you're right. Friday night, we're going to know one of the four teams. It's either going to be Oregon or it's going to be Washington. I don't think there's any doubt about it. The winner of that game is in.
Yep.
Just lock it up, right?
Regardless of what happens anywhere else, that winner is in. Absolutely. Obviously, yeah. Washington's in, but even Oregon.
I agree with that. So, Saturday, the first game is the Big 12 game. And in some ways, that's the least important. I mean, obviously, if Texas loses, they're going to be out. But if they win, I'm not sure much is in their hands. It's a tough position to be in for Texas right now. Like, the crazy thing is, Paul, if you would have, I think, told anybody at Texas at the beginning of the season that they were going to go into Tuscaloosa, they were going to beat Alabama, they were going to go win the Big 12, and the only loss on their entire resume was going to be to Oklahoma on a last-minute drive. I think everybody in Texas would have taken that and said, if we do that, we're in the playoff 100%. Don't you agree?
Oh, definitely, 100%. And it would make a lot of sense. You know, you've got an incredible win, one slip-up, and you'll be a Big 12 Power 5 champion. So absolutely, 100%.
So yeah, so it's crazy that they're sort of in this position of not really controlling their fate right now. Yeah, then we go to the SEC. It is the tipping point game. Georgia can make it extremely simple if they win. Knock Alabama out, Georgia in. Great, perfect. If Alabama wins, it becomes really, really complicated. And we're going to – I mean, let's just talk through it right now. All right, what do you think is going to happen in the game? Georgia is the team that I think right now we sort of look at as better, or we think they're better than Alabama for a whole bunch of different reasons, including that weird Iron Bowl last week. Alabama in so many ways is fortunate to just even still be in this thing. But at the same time, if you look at these matchups, it just comes down, it's head-to-head, it's coaching staff versus coaching staff, player versus player. And when these two teams have been on the field together in the Kirby Smart era, how many times has Kirby won? I believe it's just once. And it was the national championship game, and that matters. But this, to me, feels a little bit 2021-ish, where Georgia's undefeated, Georgia's the favorite, people aren't giving Alabama a chance, and lo and behold, they win that game and get into the playoff. I think it's going to be a really tough game. I think it's going to be a tough game for Georgia, and I think I'm going to pick Georgia, but man, it's nagging at me because I just think maybe Alabama's just got some type of this air of confidence. I don't want to say destiny, but you win a game like they won the Iron Bowl last week. It's a free ride for them right now. They're just rolling with it.
Yeah, there's something magical happening with Alabama. I think it's fair to say that. Where I come down on this game, Dan, is 100%. Based off history, based off what we've seen from the two teams, I cannot really fathom a game that doesn't follow the script that we've seen between these two programs, which is basically like a 58-59-minute game, one that will go down to the wire, one that will be well-played, one that's going to be very physical, tenacious, aggressive. I mean, there's so much at stake. I don't expect either one of these teams to wilt in the spotlight. My issue is like this. Like, if Jalen Milroe doesn't find Bond in the back left, depending where you're sitting, corner of the end zone on fourth and a million yards and goal, we're like Georgia by 17, right? Because Alabama is 10-2. They just lost the Iron Bowl. You'd be like Georgia by 17. So, like, how can I wrap my head around that when it's just one play, if that makes any sense? So Georgia's the safer pick for me. And despite all the magic that Alabama seems to have, Georgia is the safer pick. I don't know if that's where you come down on it, but I can't see Georgia failing this close to the finish line.
Yeah, I think they are the safer pick. You still see some of their vulnerabilities. You saw even last week when they played Georgia Tech. Yeah, they were in control of the game at the end. They were able to win it. I don't want to say comfortably, but they had a cushion. They were able to sort of grind the clock out. But they didn't look awesome. They didn't look dominant. And you're right. If Alabama had lost that game, you would be talking about them getting blown out here. But they wouldn't have the motivation they have now. Right now, it's all upside for Alabama in that they know, I would think they assume if they win, they're getting in. Now, that may not be the case, right? There is a scenario where you can look at it and say the SEC champion shouldn't be in. But it sort of leans into what I want to talk about next, which is this whole thing about the best four teams versus the four most deserving. The committee says we put in the four best teams. That's what they say.
Right.
But, you know, let's just say Georgia loses by a field goal close game to Alabama. In my heart of hearts, I would still believe Georgia is one of the best four teams in the country. And yet they probably wouldn't get in. So what does that say about this whole process, about the committee, about, I don't know, just about the flaws or you know, you look at this playoff and why has it been so bad for so many years in terms of the number of blowouts, the number of bad semifinal games? Well, maybe it's because they actually don't put the four best teams in, and I'm afraid that's where we're headed this season.
No, I think there's – like a scenario that's maybe a little bit realistic, maybe a little bit unrealistic, but it certainly like could happen where the SEC gets left out altogether. That's Washington, Florida State, Michigan win, and then Oregon and Texas win. Like, what happens then? I'm saying Alabama beats Georgia, obviously. Like, what do you do then? You can't put Alabama in ahead of Texas, right? So I don't know what the committee does there, but that's how the SEC gets left out, period.
So – all right, everyone's talking about head-to-head. If it comes down to the fourth spot, or not maybe just any spot, Alabama versus Texas, how can you put Alabama in over Texas with the head-to-head? I would sort of agree with that, but is there not an argument to say Alabama's a different team than they were in the second week of September, the first week of September? And frankly, so is Texas. Texas has not been quite as good late in the season. They lost their best running back to a season-ending injury. Yeah, head-to-head should matter, but should it matter more than what these teams have done in the last month, the last 6 weeks? And if Alabama beats Georgia, the best win, that would be the best win anybody's had all year long. Obviously, it would make Texas fans mad, but I could see a scenario where the committee jumps Alabama over them.
Sure. Hey, look, I want to like – I feel like I'm pussyfooting around this thing. I just want to cut to the chase about it. If we're going to talk about the four best teams, the issue is Florida State. That's just be flat about it. the issue with having the four best teams in is that Florida State is not one of the four best teams in the country, certainly not right now, without Jordan Travis. So that's the problem. Like, if you're going to do the four best teams in the country, you can't have Florida State in this group. You just can't. Right? Am I like being ridiculously cruel? Florida State's not one of the four best teams in the country. So, like, that's the problem. Like, Hancock said it again yesterday, didn't he? He was like, I just want to clear something up. Like, we do the best teams, not the most deserving teams. But you're going to do most deserving when you put Florida State in. That's just the flat-out truth. And I think only Seminole fans would not agree to that. Florida State's not one of the four best teams in the country without Jordan Travis. They might not be one of the four best with him, but they're definitely not without him.
I've just come around now to the idea that even though we would both agree Florida State's not in the four best right now, they're not going to leave him out.
Definitely not.
Because they just – this committee does not want to be controversial. They don't want to – they never have tried to make waves. I mean, is it just a coincidence that you start to look at the order they put these teams in? It's the zero-loss teams. Then it's the one-loss teams. Then it's the two-loss teams. Right. That's how they do it. It's not that complicated. They don't actually look too deeply into this. And I've said this, I've written it. They could Saturday night, they could meet for like 10 minutes and do the playoff. And we probably will all be able to predict exactly what they're going to do because we have every single year. Mm-hmm. They just go based on this very sort of by the book method that, frankly, that a lot of poll voters used to do for years and years and years when it was still the BCS era. So I actually don't think the committee is – yes, they're important because they're the ones choosing and voting, but they don't do what they say they're going to do, and it's certainly not what we thought it was going to be when they started this thing, which is, man, they're going to just like really start looking into, you know, all of these metrics, and they're going to go into Vegas lines and – all of these different things. They don't do that. And frankly, I don't know if the public wants them to do that. The public, the general public, the football fans who watch this thing every week, they want a world where you win something and you get something, because that's how we are used to consuming our sports. Mm-hmm. You win your division, you get into the playoffs, you get a bye, whatever. It's simple. It's easy to understand. It's not easy to understand if you are Florida State and you win all of your games and you don't get in, even though, frankly, it would be better for the playoff if they weren't there. It's crazy. Like, Georgia being number one and almost likely staying there if they win, I don't want to say they have a free pass into the final, but that line, the Georgia-Florida State betting line, if that's what it is going to be like 17 points.
Yeah, totally. Mm-hmm.
And so I guess I'm just in some ways glad this era is ending. We're moving to 12. I think there's problems with 12. There's issues with 12. We're not going to have weekends like we had last year where Ohio State and Michigan is like the biggest game ever, mm-hmm. because they're both going to be in the playoff. We're just and frankly, they may play again the next week in the Big Ten championship game. Right. So
that's right. Jeez.
It's just going to be different and it's going to be weird. It's not going to be the same, but frankly, in some ways, college football deserves this for dragging its feet and not making the playoff expand earlier.
Yeah. Can you imagine? I mean, this year's 12-team field would just be incredible. I did not want to make an argument for not putting Florida State in because I know they're going to get in at 13-0, and I believe they're going to beat Louisville even without Travis, so they're going to get in. They're just going to get their clock clean. They're going to play Georgia in the semis if that's how it shakes out, and they're going to get beat up. And that's not because Florida State isn't like a really good team with a great future, but they're just not, they don't stack up, not right now. So
okay,
that's it.
All right. So are they going to beat Louisville?
I do think they beat Louisville. I'm in awe of Louisville's season, but not really in awe of the team. I know that doesn't really make a lot of sense. Like, I don't think the team is that great. I think they've really maximized what they're about, the sum of their parts. So they're like a fun story. They're a nice team, but I still think Florida State on it just athletically has had, they've got too much for Louisville. And I think if they can continue to dumb things down enough on offense and just play careful, safe football, that's enough to beat Louisville and then get destroyed by Georgia. But that's the point that we're making.
Yeah. It would be very clarifying for the committee. It would ease a lot of this tension if Louisville did win the game. But, you know, you watch Florida State last week against Florida, and Florida's not a very good team. But playing at home, very motivated to win that game, it was impressive in a way that Florida State was able to come through it, kind of control the second half. Their defense did a great job. Now, obviously, Florida had a backup quarterback as well. I just think the issue is, and maybe we'll see it against Louisville, the offense is just significantly worse with Tate Rodemaker. Mm-hmm. It's just not the same dynamism. You're not going to get the same big play pop. You're not going to get the same mobility from the quarterback position. All of those things make that offense work with the weapons they have at receiver. Like, I think this could be a game that's it's a 17-14 type game. And it just comes down to, you know, a play here or there, a last minute field goal, something like that. But, you know, I guess I just, the playoff has become this reward. It's a reward. If you get in, it's a punishment. If you don't get in, you can't punish the players. That mentality is what's going to get Florida State in. I don't necessarily think that's the right mentality for what this product is supposed to be, but, it's not personal. I love Mike Norvell. I love what they've done at Florida State, but it's just sort of a disappointing notion that they could struggle through this Louisville game and then end up playing Georgia, and it's just going to be a bloodbath in the Sugar Bowl. So
let's do this. Let me give you some scenarios because we are talking about this stuff. Okay, so all the other unbeatens hold serve. Texas wins the Big 12, Florida State loses. What happens there? So you got Georgia, you got Michigan, you got Washington.
Yeah.
Texas, right? Texas yeah. slots in, number four. Okay.
Ahead of Alabama, right? Yeah, because Alabama would have two losses. Now, yeah, I mean, so Texas is behind Ohio State right now in the rankings, but I will assume that Texas beating Oklahoma State would move them up into fifth, and then would move them up ahead of Ohio State and then ahead of Alabama because Alabama would lose and then ahead of Florida State because Florida State loses. That's the easy one.
That's an easy one. So really, like, if that's all that happens, that's the only quote-unquote upset. Even if you toss Oregon beating Washington into that mix, it's really simple for the committee. Like, that's still a very simple thing, which really just gets back to the point. Like, it. Do we even want to talk about Michigan losing to Iowa? Do you foresee that as even?
Well, I was going to bring that up. I don't see it. Do you?
I don't see it. But what's the, like, it's so unlikely to me just based off Iowa's offensive issues. Like, I haven't even considered what the impact would be. Honestly, Michigan is not going to make it a 12-1 and not Big Ten champs because they don't have the resume, or they do. I mean, they have Ohio State. Yeah. And they'll have two top 10 wins. I don't know. I haven't even thought about that. What plays out if Michigan loses and all the other favorites hold?
If all the other favorites hold and Michigan loses, I still think Michigan goes in ahead of Texas.
Well, Michigan will have a better win than Texas's best win.
Yeah.
They'll have two better wins. Probably. No, Alabama will probably stay ahead of Penn State in the final rankings, but they'll have one win that's clearly better and a second win that's just as good in Penn State. So yeah, you're probably right. But conference championship versus no conference championship, that might be the tiebreaker.
Yeah, if Iowa's the team that totally throws this all into chaos, I don't even know what to do. But we've just seen this matchup, or we've seen this Big Ten championship game so many times. It just doesn't feel realistic that Michigan would lose, does it?
Only way they lose is if Iowa scores a defensive touchdown. If Iowa scores a defensive touchdown, they will win the game. Like,
well,
good luck. Like, get that pick six or something like that, because that's really the only way they win.
Well, and anything can happen, obviously, if it's one play or whatever. But I do think for Michigan, the one thing I was super impressed by in the Ohio State game was just how well they took care of the ball, you know, and that's where it just looked like they were the better team than Ohio State. Is McCarthy at the quarterback position was just so in control. He's not always amazing or brilliant or whatever, but they're never trying to do things they can't do. They're never trying to do things that are too difficult, that are beyond their grasp. They're taking big risks. They're just playing within themselves. And McCarthy's got enough experience that they don't, he just doesn't feel like he's ever about to commit a turnover. Mm-hmm. So to go back to the point about the Iowa game, yeah, if something like that happens, it would be a bit of a fluke, and maybe that changes the dynamic. It's just hard for me to see it happening because Michigan just has been so solid.
All right, so how do you want to talk about how Ohio State gets in? Because that's also possible. You're right.
I don't think they can. I mean, what would have to – okay, tell me.
Here we go. Ready? Georgia wins, they're in. Michigan wins, they're in. Oregon or Washington, they're right. in. There's your three.
Florida State loses.
Florida State loses, and Texas loses, right?
Yeah.
And then you're looking at 11-1 Ohio State with a six-point road loss to Michigan, Ohio State being their number one team in the country for the committee for the first 2 weeks. You have 11-2 Texas. That's not even a conference chant. Then you have 11-1 Ohio State and 11-2 Alabama. I mean, I don't think it's even that complicated. I mean, they're in.
Can you imagine Ohio State backdooring in for the second straight year?
And playing Georgia again?
Oh, my God.
Wow. Difference being C.J. Stroud is not going to be around. So I don't know. I don't know how that matchup would go. I mean, can't count the Buckeyes out against anybody, even though they don't really beat top five teams. But like when you say it the way that I just put it, it's really not that complicated, obviously. And you could easily could see that happening.
Well, on the Texas front, yeah, I think Texas is the clear favorite going into this game. But I would say it's no better than maybe 65-35 the Texas wins.
Yeah.
Maybe less than that. Oklahoma State's very capable of beating them.
If there was a coach, a Big 12 coach, who I would want to be delivering my pregame message to play Texas in their final Big 12 championship game, it would be Mike Gundy. Mike Gundy is going to want to win. I mean, obviously he wants to win this game, but I feel like he's going to have there's something a little bit extra about their motivation to win this game. Not that they need it. So, yeah, definitely Oklahoma State can win this game. It's silly to say that they can't.
What a season that would be for Oklahoma State. It just seems like yesterday we were talking about them getting blown out by South Alabama.
I know. It's crazy. We were talking about how bad it was, how ugly this could get, playing as kid at QB, no idea what's going on. You know, we were really doing doomsday stuff, but incredible. I mean, if it wasn't for Saban to be the best in season turnaround of any team in the country, even then it's pretty close to what Alabama's done.
It seems like year after year, the Big 12 championship game is the most dramatic, best game to watch. There's been some absolute humdingers in that game. Wasn't it a couple years ago, Baylor, Oklahoma State was just a classic?
That's right. At the final, like right at the goal line, an inch short or something like that.
It was a goal line stand.
Last year was awesome. Remember TCU and K-State last year was sick.
That was overtime, right?
Mm-hmm. That was OT. So that was the Max Duggan, like, put you on my back game. So
Oklahoma, Texas have had one that stands out as being a really good game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, there's been some – the Big 12 just has always delivered in that early window. It's the SEC that sometimes is pretty is a blowout, seems like a blowout more often than not. Mm-hmm. All right, let's just go backwards a little bit. Like, what do we think is going to happen Friday in the Pac-12? Because you look at the number, Oregon's a significant favorite in this game. And I think there's a lot of reasons why that should be the case. One of them being it's just hard to beat a team twice in the same year. The circumstances are totally different from when they played in Seattle. Oregon should have won that game. You had the fourth down calls by Dan Lanning that blew up in his face. But let me give you sort of the other side of it, which is the Washington side, which is to say – winners win.
Yeah.
And we've done nothing but find ways to win the entire season, including, by the way, last week, Kalen DeBoer going for fourth and one in a tie game, like from his own like 29-yard line.
29, yeah, with the end around. Wild.
One of the ballsiest calls I've seen. Now, maybe it wasn't because basically if you're Washington, you say, all right, well, maybe we lose. But it doesn't matter because our season comes down to the Pac-12 championship game anyway. Right. Mm-hmm. Win in, lose out. And that's probably the case. Still, in a rivalry game, I mean, that takes some stones to make that call. And he did it. It worked. And Washington just kind of has that TCU vibe from last year where no matter what they do, everything just kind of works in their favor. So that's the argument to me for Washington. They've just gotten good at winning.
Yeah, absolutely. They are the 1,000-yard stare team of the season, and that they do not get cowed by any sort of like fourth quarter situation where a lot of other teams would crumble. And that is, like you said, a byproduct of, I think I have the math right, it's eight games in a row decided by no fewer than 10 points. I think only one game was decided by more than 7 or 8. So there's a lot to be said for that. And we talked about this a lot with TCU last season, Dan, like about how a team that knows what it takes to win a close game, as dumb and cliched as that is, like that stuff pays off, like in this situation. So Washington knows how to win. Give them a lot of credit. My eyeballs, Dan, that have been watching football for a couple months now are telling me that Oregon is an easily better team than Washington, and they are going to take care of business on Friday. And I only think the way that they do not is if that we see the same thing that we saw in Seattle, which is self-inflicted errors, whether coaching decisions, physical errors, that give Washington a chance to win this game. I'm guessing they're going to be a little bit more buttoned up this time from Dan Lanning on deck.
I agree with that. I think Oregon probably, I don't want to say rolls, but if they win by 14 points, wouldn't shock me whatsoever. I think they're really good. I hope at the end of the day we get Oregon, Michigan in the Rose Bowl, because okay, I think that's a hell of a semifinal if that's what we get.
It would be one of the best semifinals of the 14 format on paper, easily to me. That's just an incredible, incredible matchup. I mean, two teams that have just decimated people. So I would love that. And 14 points to me wouldn't even bat an eye. I mean, Washington is good at keeping things close and they're good at responding. But this Oregon group, I mean, look what they did to Oregon State compared to Oregon State and Washington, despite the, you know, difference in field. They just controlled the Beavers from the jump. A 24-point win that might as well have been 48 points. So Oregon's playing at a high, high, high level right now.
And if Oregon wins, does Bo Nix take home the Heisman?
I think so, right? I mean, I know there's going to be a groundswell support for Daniels, and I don't make it out to be like he doesn't deserve it. I'm not voting. I don't really care. I think Bo Nix has been better than Daniels, as great as he's been. I mean, Bo Nix is completing 78% of his attempts. You know, I think that these things have to be taken into account, as is the fact that he could be a playoff team and Daniels is second placed in the West. So I think that'll end up being 1-2, and I don't know who third would be, honestly. I really don't, if Bo Nix and Oregon win on Friday.
Yeah, I think it's probably just between those two. But most of the time we go to the Heisman ceremony or we watch the Heisman ceremony and we know probably 99% who's going to win. Mm-hmm. I think there's enough support for Daniels, and there's probably a bit of a SEC bias inherent in the way the voting is conducted that I would go in not 100% sure. But like I said, who cares? You know,
it could be anything. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely down to those two guys. One, a Pac-12 transfer to the SEC, and then the other guy, vice versa, which is very interesting.
All right, we got to get into the coaching carousel because it's happening. It's in some ways almost ending.
Yep.
Not the most robust season of coaching hires, but A&M, that was the big one out there. They end up with Mike Elko. I think it's a solid hire. I think they ended up in the right place, probably, given the options available. There was a time on Saturday where it looked like they were maybe going to get Mark Stoops, and then there was some level of revolt, maybe a strong word, but unease or discomfort among the A&M booster class that pretty much said, no, we did not just pay $77 million to go get a guy who, while he's been very good at Kentucky, you know, has kind of been like a 7-8 win coach at Kentucky. Now, you could also argue
all right, well, why did you pay $77 million to get rid of Jimbo to go get Duke's head coach? That's certainly a fair question. But Mike Elko has been there as a defensive coordinator, so he knows what he's walking into. He gets Texas A&M and knows all the quirks behind it. If you could go back to the start of the season and say, all right, this is going to be Jimbo's last year, and at the end of this thing, Mike Elko is going to be the next coach, I would say A&M fans might be a little disappointed in that outcome.
Yep.
But it does feel like a hire that was made for the right reasons, and there's enough substance there with Elko and what he brings to the table that I think there's a chance that it could be pretty good.
Yeah, I think it's a safe hire, and I don't mean that in a negative way. I think it's like I wrote the other day, it's a high floor hire. I think Mike Elko gets you to a certain place just from an effort, development, defense perspective that almost guarantees that you're not going to have these types of 5-7, 6-6 type of seasons. Nothing is guaranteed. But when you add in like the expected talent level, the way that his defenses play, I thought he hired a very good staff at Duke. They're not all going to follow him, would be my respect. But if he hires a good staff, as I expect him to do, it seems like you set yourself up for like a baseline of success and you don't really vary from it. I think the fair question is not even one that we could answer or attempt to answer is like, what do you know about Mike Elko through 25 games at Duke that makes you think or believe that like he's the breakthrough guy? I don't know. But I do like the fact that he's defense first. They haven't had a defense coach since R.C. Slocum. And I like the fact that he knows it. He knows the place. Like, for example, when he got to that press conference, he knew they were going to do that dumb, wacky shit at the end. Like, he knew he was going to have to sway back and forth. It wasn't a Dana Altman, you know, pig suey situation where he was going to be like, oh, my God, who are these guys in sailor outfits and what are they doing with their hands? Like, he knew what was happening. So I think there's some power in that. So I like the hire. I'm not like gaga for it, but I think that's fair. Like it's hard to be gaga for it. And I don't think it's like the wrong reaction to be like, let's wait and see how it plays out.
I'm impressed that you remember the Dana Altman situation because
how could you forget?
You're not a college basketball guy.
I know, but that is even not being a college basketball guy, that's been like, I've seen that referenced. When would that have been? About 20 years ago?
Oh, it was a long time ago now. It was less than 20, but like maybe
I've seen that referenced a lot. Like
12 or 13 for sure.
Oh, really? That few?
Well, no. What? No, you know what? It might have been. Yeah, God, it was a long time ago.
I've seen that like as the like written in news stories about as like the most famous what have I done moment in coaching hire history. And I've Googled it and YouTubed it. It's fantastic. Like he's like, oh my God, I didn't know what was happening. So that's not the situation with Elko. He gets what's going on down there.
All right, we'll get to Arkansas in a second. But I do want to just put out this tweet from Travis Brown, who covers Texas A&M. I got so much response to this from the coaching community, from NFL people, from everybody when I retweeted this.
This is amazing.
All right. And again, I'm quoting from the tweet of a guy who covers Texas A&M. Ross Bjork, the A&M AD, said they researched every team to win an SEC championship and national championship in the college football playoff era. The key factors. Number one, defensive-minded head coach. Number two, championship-level culture. Number three, recruit and develop elite NFL-type talent.
Ooh.
And number four, play great offense and score a lot of points with a high-level QB. So wait a second. You're telling me that to win an SEC and a national championship, you need to be good on defense.
Yes.
You need to have a great culture.
Mm-hmm.
You need to have NFL future NFL talent.
Yes.
And you need to score a lot of points with an elite QB. Well, you guys at A&M, man, you've really cracked the code there.
Yeah, seriously. They must have like hired they must have created an algorithm to figure out how to come to that conclusion.
AI is just changing the game here.
Yeah, look, I think that you should like I've gone back to 1869 on this, and I know that this is a tremendous amount of research. I got the Excel spreadsheet for it. The best teams in the country for 154 years have scored more points than the teams that they have played. And I think that A&M is kind of missing the boat here. The real key is to outscore your competition. And I hope that Ross Bjork didn't miss the boat on that, because he's obviously done a lot of research into what this is about. It's laughable, obviously, and we're poking fun at it because everyone wants that. It's about, you know, actually putting it into action. That's the tough part for A&M and everyone else.
The key to winning championships is to be good at football. Who knew?
Yeah, who knew?
Who knew?
Who knew? Ross Bjork just found out. A&M just found out. Okay.
Yeah. Well, these ADs, these administrators, man, they love to tell you how complicated everything is and how much they know and how much they've researched. And it's all a bunch of crap. They were going to go hire Mark Stoops, and then the boosters revolted. And now they're hiring Mike Elko because, frankly, there wasn't a ton of interest in the job. That's just the reality. Everybody's making $7, $8 million now.
Right.
Everyone's got resources with NIL. Everyone's got facilities. Like, people just did not want to leave a good situation to take that job. So, anyway, good luck to Mike Elko. Mississippi State has hired Jeff Lebby, the offensive coordinator at Oklahoma, and somebody who's been in the SEC before. He was with Lane at Ole Miss. He was at Baylor. He's Art Briles' son-in-law.
Yep.
And was on the Baylor staff. That's where he came up. I'm going to just say this right now. This is the worst Power Five hire since Charlie Weiss at Kansas.
Okay.
Now okay. I put Zach Arnett. Now you could say, well, what about Zach Arnett? I put Zach Arnett in a different category.
Yes, agreed. Different circumstances.
Different circumstances.
So tell me about Lebby. Why is this the worst hire in 11 or 12 years?
Well, a couple things. One, I think Oklahoma was not that sad about getting rid of him, for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, I think it sort of is the kind of hire you would have made in like 2016 instead of 2023. Oh, just go get the Baylor offense guy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, totally. Is the Baylor offense even a thing anymore?
Mm-hmm.
Not really.
It's been swallowed up and by other offenses and become part of a bigger scheme.
Yeah. I don't think he is mature enough to be an SEC head coach. Without getting too specific, there are people who have been in proximity to him in a work environment who are just not impressed with him.
Mm-hmm.
And his abilities as a leader and the guy who might be able to run a program. And then the whole thing earlier this year when Briles was on the field at Oklahoma and then he sort of refused to apologize and they had to make him apologize. And like, how much is Art going to be around? I mean, that all that stuff. I think this has no chance of working. And I have not heard anyone that I respect or think is very smart about this stuff who believes that guy's got what it takes to be a big-time head coach.
Yeah, this is a tremendous roll of the dice, like a tremendous roll of the dice. And like any roll of the dice, like you could come up sevens or whatever the good one is. Like, that is the possibility. But like, you know, I hadn't thought of this, but you're exactly right. Like, this really reeks of that mid to late-ish 2010s era when you were just like, get the offensive coordinator at the highest scoring offense in the country and like let him do the same thing there that he as he did there. My immediate response to it was this, like, you want to win the Egg Bowl and like you build your whole life around winning the Egg Bowl and then, you know, doing other things around it, but you want to win that game. I mean, like, Ole Miss hired Lane Kiffin. Like, Lane Kiffin had been the head coach at Tennessee, at USC. I mean, he'd been offensive coordinator at Alabama. He'd been a head coach in the NFL. He's Lane Kiffin. And you're hiring Jeff Lebby. And this is not like, I don't know him and I don't know what you know about him. So I'm not going to like just like say that, you know, it's because of this, that, or the other. It's just fact, plain resume. Jeff Lebby is not a proven head coach, you know. And like you said, he did not draw rave reviews this past season just for his on-field work at Oklahoma. So I'm really skeptical. It could work out. But like you said, like, there's a lot against this hire that makes me believe that they're going to regret this. And this is not going to pan out well in 3 years or maybe 4 years.
Do you remember when Mike Jinks got hired at Bowling Green? Do you remember how that happened?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Uh-huh.
You remember that?
That was after Dino.
The athletic director just Googled best offense in the NCAA.
Right.
And
meanwhile, Mike Jinks that hadn't sort left of the led state him of Texas to in 30 years.
Yeah.
And he's up.
It just feels like something along those lines. I don't like it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Don't like it at all. Like,
this is a different SEC that is adding more talent.
Well,
better teams are coming in and pushing Mississippi State farther down. So maybe you got to be quirky and different to do it. But like, and the last thing on it, it's not 2016 anymore because there really are no quirky, like everything is kind of caught up on offense. Like if you look at the trend of the sport, there is no real edgier seat, cutting edge offense currently operating in college football, to the best of my knowledge. Like offenses are fantastically good, but there's no team doing something so different and so quirky right. that you would go out and get him and be like, do something different. So there's just not a lot about it that I love. Anyway, Mississippi, way too much time on the Bulldogs.
Mississippi State's arguably the biggest loser in SEC realignment because it doesn't just push them down further, but I just think their life without divisions is going to be tougher. I mean, maybe one of these years they catch a Vandy, but I actually think playing more East teams doesn't help them. It's going to be tough. Don't love the hire. We'll see. I do like what Michigan State did getting Jonathan Smith. I think that's very solid. Now, obviously he does not have the experience or the credentials working in the Midwest, but I think he's a serious guy who took a program at Oregon State that was down in the dumps, got them very competent. You know, I don't know what the ceiling is at Michigan State. Obviously, we've seen them get into the playoff. We've seen what Mark D'Antonio did there. It was very good. Had a couple years where they were at least sniffing around national titles. I don't know if that's going to happen again under Jonathan Smith, but yeah, I think that's a great pivot for them coming out of a very messy season and divorce from Mel Tucker.
Yeah, I mean, Smith is, like you said, a really serious guy, like a serious guy with a plan. And that plan at Oregon State, like he didn't deviate from it, took no shortcuts. And the end result was, as you guys have seen, they're 18-7 since the start of last season. So he's done fantastic work there. I think culturally, the ethos of the program that Smith built at Oregon State fits what Michigan State wants to be. Similarly to Texas A&M, well, I think Smith is a more proven and probably a better coach than Elko at this point in time. I think there are similar questions about what end game success looks like and what would be an acceptable like ceiling. You know, this is a different Big Ten than it was, I think, than even 6 or 7 years ago when D'Antonio was doing it. You're adding in teams from the Pac-12. It's just going to be more difficult for Michigan State to go 12-0 or go 11-1. So I think this, we need to think about what really good looks like, but yeah, he's a guy who can get this thing turned around the right way, probably within 24 months. I think even in the NIL portal era, it's going to be tough for him to get this roster in shape in 2024.
Fran Brown is the new head coach at Syracuse, off the Georgia staff, bunch of Kirby Smart assistants getting head coaching jobs. Not surprisingly, that's just kind of the way it goes. I don't really have any comment on the hire. Syracuse is a tough job. We'll see. I don't know if you know anything.
Yeah, I mean, Fran Brown is not really a Kirby Smart guy as much as he's a Matt Rhule guy and as a Northeast guy. And I think there's an aspect of, like, being familiar with a program-building coach and a classic, you know, title-winning program like Georgia that spoke to Syracuse. I like it when schools take chances on guys who aren't coordinators, and specifically like coaches of color who don't get a lot of chance to be coordinator. This is a really good sign for college football, and I'm not going to say Fran Brown's going to be good or not, but yeah. I do like to see this hire. So I'm in favor of it. I hope he does well. One thing he will do well is recruit. He'll do a very good job. Considering Syracuse doesn't have a great NIL situation right now, I think he'll do a nice job in traditional recruiting.
Sean Lewis is headed to San Diego State. Sean Lewis was in the MAC forever and then gets hired by Dion to be the offensive coordinator and then gets knifed in the back by Dion at the end of the season. Not surprising that he gets a head coaching job out of it, frankly, better than the one he had before, way better than the one he had before, because I think people recognized, at least early in the season, that he was doing a good job. It just seems Dion couldn't recognize that. I think it's a good, solid move for San Diego State.
Yeah, me too. I mean, look, like, I think there's two takeaways from this for me. Number one is Sean Lewis at Kent State, what he achieved there and what he did on offense in specific there, I think spoke to a lot of people in the industry. I think as a guy who can like take a really crappy situation and try to make some lemonade out of it. For San Diego State's perspective, this is clearly a huge break from the past, geez, almost 15 years of what their program has looked like from Hoke to Long back to Hoke. So they're going to actually try to have, they're going to try to actually score points and take advantage of the athletic ability of their recruiting base, which makes a lot of sense to me because it's been a while since they've scored points.
Is Houston the best job open still?
I think Houston is the job to me that you can do the most with. Yeah. So, yeah, that by definition makes it the best job available.
So it has not been filled yet, but I don't know. There was some talk maybe about Cliff Kingsbury. I would not do that personally. Jeff Traylor clearly going to be in the mix there. So that's one to keep an eye on.
I want to say something about Cliff real quick.
Yep.
Because in the thought of like what his next step would be, I know he spent it this year off field at USC. I do not think that he's ever going to coach in college again as a head coach. There is too much that goes into it. And Cliff Kingsbury, like for all of his, of this perception or the old perception that he's like this guy who just like sits in a room for a couple hours a day and draws X's and O's. He does not want to do like all the other stuff. Like he is not interested. He is not want to be a guy who's like on the phone all day, recruiting his own guys, doing portal, doing NIL. So I just don't see him wanting to get back into this on that kind of basis. So Jeff Traylor to me is the best fit and the smartest fit for Houston.
Yeah. We'll see what direction they go, but it's obviously a big hire for them. They got to do something to raise their level in the Big 12. They were way short of it coming in this year. All right. And we got to get to Arkansas finally. Oof. Bobby Petrino is the offensive coordinator at Arkansas. Let me repeat that. Bobby Petrino is now the new offensive coordinator at Arkansas. I'm gobsmacked.
Yeah, stunned.
Because, well, you know why. You know why. We were all there. We were all alive. We all watched it. We saw the neck brace.
Mm-hmm.
And then the volleyball player and the press conference with the athletic director and the HR violations and all of it. And honestly, like, everyone knows what kind of person Bobby Petrino is, how he treats people. He's never left. What's amazing is the guy's never left any job like on good terms. And yet this is now the second time he's been hired by Arkansas. And the same thing happened to Louisville. Louisville took him back.
That's right.
What is the deal? I don't understand. Like, how can somebody who is so loathsome, who people just do not like, people do not like him. They don't like working with him. They don't like being around him. And yet they hire him back. Let me tell you how. At least for Arkansas. They're down bad right now at Arkansas. Oh, yeah. They're down. They're as down bad could be. And there is a group of boosters and people who are influential within the program who have this nostalgia for, you know, the teams that he had that, you know, they got to a Sugar Bowl. They were in the mix for titles. Frankly, the year that he was fired, I think I had Arkansas as preseason number one that year, maybe. Like they were going to be really good. They looked projected to be really good. And I believe that Sam Pittman and Hunter Yurecek, the AD, were forced to do this or else they were going to be the next ones out the door. That's what I believe.
That's crazy. That is crazy.
Well, if you're Sam Pittman, why would you agree to this? Because you know, Sam Pittman is obviously fighting for his job next year. He knows that the first sign of trouble, he's going to be out and Bobby Petrino is going to be the interim head coach. That's obvious.
Yes.
So yes. Why else would he agree to this?
Like, I just don't get it. Like, okay, I don't get it on a lot of levels, but let's just go back like to the schematic portion of it. I don't get it from like just a coaching perspective. why you want Bobby Petrino in the year 2024 to be your offensive coordinator.
It's been a long time since he's been good.
It's been since he was at Arkansas, or maybe his 1 year at Western Kentucky, where his offenses were actually still good, like really, really good.
Well, he had Lamar Jackson for one year, you know, an amazing year at Louisville.
But what year was that of his tenure? I should have Googled it. So whatever it is, it's still been a significant amount of time since he's had offenses that were on the cutting edge of things, or that you felt were like, if we got the pieces, they can't stop us. So just from that point of view, like, it's a bad hire, just from that point of view. But obviously there's a lot more to it that makes it a bad hire, like you said.
Right. So 2016 was the Lamar Jackson year.
Right. Okay.
They went 9-4. They were ranked 20th in the country. Now you could argue, you have Lamar Jackson, why are you not better than 9-4?
Mm-hmm.
You could certainly make that case. They lost to Clemson, although that was kind of a classic. They got drilled at Houston late in the year. They lost to Kentucky. Like, they kind of faded down the stretch that season. And then the next year they were disappointing. And then in 2018, they absolutely cratered. They went 2-8 and they fired him.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then he goes Missouri State, 18-15 in 3 years at Missouri State. Okay. Nothing great. In his last year at Missouri State, he was 5-6. Like, yeah. I just don't buy the Petrino hype. This past year at A&M, when he was calling plays, he had a ton of talent and they stunk. Like, I don't understand the enthusiasm from the Arkansas side, from the fan and booster side for this. I think it's bizarre to me.
Yeah. And look, I understand why Petrino takes this job, because I don't know if there's a lot of, I don't want to use the word shame. It seems a little bit strong, but in that ballpark, whatever a softer word than that is, I don't think that's going to keep him from taking a job. I just don't know why Arkansas also lacks the same shame. Like, this guy embarrassed you. He didn't just embarrass you. He screwed you over, your entire program. Like you said, they were on the up and up and things were looking really good with Tyler Wilson and those guys. They were a 10-win team. They'd been in a BCS New Year's Six Bowl, and he screwed them over. He screwed your program over, and they haven't really recovered since then. And you're like, yeah, please come back. That's embarrassing. That's embarrassing for the boosters and for the fans. If you're walking back with open arms, then you should be embarrassed, because he screwed you over. It's like, welcome back a partner who screwed you over. It just doesn't make sense.
But he is going to be the interim coach at some point next season.
Yeah, probably. But yeah, probably. Because he will become the interim coach because his offense is so bad.
All right, a couple other jobs open. Indiana, they fired Tom Allen. Indiana paying like $15 million to change football coaches is kind of crazy, but
yep.
That's because they signed him to a terrible deal. Duke obviously is looking for a coach with Mike Elko off to A&M, and that's a difficult hire for Nina King, the athletic director there. Middle Tennessee State's open, UTEP's open, New Mexico's open, Boise's open. That's a lot of Mountain West.
Yeah.
Or I guess UTEP's in Conference USA. Conference USA, by the way, adding Delaware. Did you see that?
Yeah, that's a big one. When you get a chance to add the smallest state in the country into your repertoire, you must.
I think Joe Biden working his magic on that one to get his alma mater into Conference USA.
What's really going to – I mean, program, speaking of UTEP, like, they're just sitting there thinking, man, now we can cash in on the lucrative Delaware recruiting market. Like, this is finally going to open doors for us with the Wilmington high schools. So I know this is big time for Conference USA.
What a strange collection of schools Conference USA is right now.
El Paso and Delaware in the same league.
Kennesaw State, Jacksonville State. It's a Sam Houston State.
Sam Houston.
It's a motley crew of teams. Anyone catching your eye in the transfer portal? Tyler Van Dyke's in there, quarterback from Miami.
Nobody.
Yeah.
Not yet. I mean, if you want somebody good out of the portal, game changer, that's not going to happen yet. It's not that good a group right now.
It'll be interesting to see. There's going to be a lot of names in there. I mean, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of names. It is where the action is at this time of year. People trying to fill their holes in the roster and upgrade certain positions, and NIL money flowing around. It's going to be wild. All right. Yep. I think that's all the time we got for this week. Covered everything. Conference championships coming up. Next time we talk to you guys early next week, we will know who the 14 playoff is going to be, and we'll talk about it. Until then, for Eric Smith, our college sports editor at USA Today Sports, and for Paul Meyerberg, I'm Dan Wolkin. Enjoy it. We'll talk to you when we know the playoffs.
The College Football Fix Podcast. With Paul Meyerberg and Dan Wolkin. This is the College Football Fix Podcast from USA Today Sports.